Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today you're listening to a takeover special.
So, this is Solange here, dropping in, Liz, to ask you how you're getting on with the sensors that BevArt have sent to you.
Right. So I've been sent some sensors by BevArt to test and play around with. And I'm currently working on making a video review of their product. So
what are the products that they've sent you?
They sent me this little sensor. So it's about the size of a postage stamp, and it measures the temperature and the relative humidity in a space. I've set mine up in two areas. So I'm taking information from two places, the front of my house and the back of my house. That's what I have to work with. But I'm hoping to actually learn some interesting information, maybe about like where is all the humidity in my house settling. Probably my hypothesis is in the back of the house where the bathroom is.
I mean, I'm a bit of a nerd about the humidity in my actual house.
Yeah. But
I totally geeked out.
The dehumidifier and everything?
Yeah.
I don't have any dehumidifiers. I just have natural airflow.
Oh, so sustainable.
And very un-American.
I look forward to seeing the video.
Yeah, it'll be out in the next few weeks on our YouTube channel.
Nice.
But moving on from BevArt, actually, our episode today is not featuring us. It's featuring the Heritage Youth Network, who are a UK-wide-based organization that empowers people to rescue and restore historic buildings and spaces for the benefit of their local communities. So we have some lovely ladies that we're going to listen to now and hear a little bit about how they have experienced their time in the heritage sector. And then they'll be discussing something about digital media.
Yeah, I think this will be an interesting episode for anyone who might have stumbled across this podcast in kind of part of their journey on trying to decide in which way they want to be involved in heritage.
Because there are so many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really what we're talking about a lot this season as well.
Yeah, the early career phase.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Lots of struggles.
Yeah. Well, and thank you so much to our podcast takeover folk. Thank you so much.
Let's listen now.
Hello, we are the Heritage Network Youth Forum. We created the Heritage Network Youth Forum 2 years ago in 2023 to act as a voice for young people in the heritage sector and to support their needs, their interests, and to advocate for them. It can often be a tricky sector to get into, so we act as a space for learning, encouragement, and also as a bit of like we all help each other out, and we can often act as a bit of an agony aunt if people have any kind of problems or are in need of advice. So I'm Grace, I'm the Heritage Trainee for Scotland with the network, and Becca, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Becca. I am a postgraduate student, finished in October, and I'm now kind of looking to go into heritage.
Yeah, hi, I'm Emily. I left uni really wanting to get into the heritage sector. And I was lucky to get an apprenticeship in archives and museums. So I currently work in Scottish Borders doing that, and I love it.
Hi, I'm Kate. I currently work in Amgiva Cymru, which is based in Wales in the UK. And it is a network of 7 museums across Wales. And I work in the youth engagement department. So the idea is to get young people involved in the collections, as well as like shaping the programming at Amgiva Cymru. And I've been in that role for about coming up to 2.5 years now. So I'm approaching my anniversary in June.
So what made you guys want to pursue a career in heritage?
So previously I had worked in like sort of the cultural sector in Wales, and it's a really unique sort of environment, because I often joke that it's not like a family tree. It's a bush in terms of Wales, because everyone knows everyone. Everyone's worked in like the similar organisations and like taken over roles from other people. So even though it's quite small, it's quite friendly at the same time as a result, and there's a real camaraderie between the different sectors. So I worked in the performing arts, and I transitioned over to heritage mainly because this role in youth engagement came up, and it was something that I was really passionate about myself. I've always adored heritage, even as a child, just going to like different various historical sites across Wales, and we're really, really blessed in that regard. We've got like sort of like the highest number of castles anywhere in Europe. There's just like an indication of like how historical and like how much heritage there is in Wales. And it's just something that I've always really found fascinating. And the chance to be involved in youth engagement just means that like people and the generation like after me can still enjoy those experiences that I had myself as a young person.
So I think for me, for heritage, I actually didn't know what it was before university. I've always had an interest in geography and history, and I could never decide which one I wanted to pick. So I decided to do both as a course. And then it was actually one of my modules I picked was heritage conservation. And that kind of sparked my interest in what is heritage. And I think that gave me quite a basic understanding of it. And I was especially interested in historic buildings, the values of it, who uses them, why do we keep them? And I think that just went into further along. And then I decided, oh, I might want to further this interest and do a master's. And so I've just done one in heritage studies. And I think that's where I kind of my interest as well. And I think also my mum is a planner as well, so that kind of rubbed off on me. Her love for historic buildings and the whole nature of it. And so, yeah, just at the minute looking to get into it, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, my kind of story is pretty similar, especially what Kate was saying about like growing up and loving heritage before you kind of even know what heritage is. And you don't really know what the kind of connection is to you yet, but you're like developing these things. I've always loved going to museums, and I was like never without a book when I was younger, especially like I had this wee like Scotland book, and it was all about like the history of Scotland, and I was obsessed with it, and it's very kind of stereotypical, but I loved it. And then as I got older, started to kind of fall in love with history and literature and politics and like how they all interlink. So then I went to uni and I done English literature and history, and just became like really, really passionate about all that goes on with heritage. And I just think it's really important that people understand their heritage, so they understand who they are as humans. And I also think I started to see kind of how fragile heritage can be, and how sometimes it can be very quickly wiped away from people, or you know, buildings can disappear, artifacts can disappear. So I think I just started to realise how kind of important it was, and I would love to play a part, hopefully, in kind of sustaining it for generations to enjoy in the future.
I really agree with that, because I didn't do a literature degree. I did a Welsh degree, so I'm a second language Welsh speaker, and it was the exact same sort of realisation of like, the language and heritage and the way people lived is so like intrinsically linked in terms of the culture. And I really saw that through my degree, and the idea of like things potentially being lost. There's always been sort of like through like the history of like Welsh language rights, there's always been a bit of a struggle to try and like get it recognised as official language, have it respected the same level as English in Wales. I could go into that and use my student degree, but I won't bore you guys with that. But yeah, the idea that the language had to fight for its right to exist and be used by the next generations in the same way that heritage in a way still has to fight to still exist for the next generations coming on, so they understand their own history and culture as well. So yeah, I totally, totally agree with you, Grace.
Yeah, it's definitely a kind of monumental discovery, isn't it? It can define who you are and how you view the world when you have these discoveries, but they're not like a one-time thing. You have them hopefully throughout your whole life. But yeah, I don't know how you feel about that, Emily.
Very similar to all three of you, to be honest. I grew up going to old churches and National Trust properties, and I loved them so much. I've always loved history, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I didn't realise that history was the thing that I loved that passed through everything I did. And I think I probably assumed that I couldn't work in that. I think I probably just thought those things are there to be enjoyed, but you couldn't actually work in them. You might be able to earn some money so that you can spend more time in them or go on holidays to visit these places, like these lovely old castles and things like that. But it never really occurred to me that you could actually have a career in it. I think I remember when I was younger, I would just always want to go to anything old or see anything old, like any graveyard or any kind of. I remember there was a local museum that had some skeletons that were like under a piece of glass, and I just thought that was brilliant. And it's like other people found it a bit weird, but I was like, that's brilliant, it's amazing, I can actually see them. And it was just, I just found it fascinating. And I think I did theology at university, and I sort of had a bit of a panic of thinking, oh my God, does that mean that I'm religious? Did I not realize that I was religious? But actually it was just because I loved spending time in the churches themselves. And I think it wasn't the religion that I was trying to get back to. It was the connection between me and the people from centuries ago that were actually stood in the same building before, and I'd actually sat down or touched the wall or carved something. And I thought it's probably because it's the closest I can get to the actual people. So it's definitely the buildings are definitely something that interests me more than probably more than objects, actually, because you actually feel like you're within the history rather than just holding it.
Yeah. I've got this image of you like pressed with your face against the glass.
Yeah. And any kind of like any tunnel or tiny door or, you know, a little secret room. I just always loved it. And I couldn't quite figure out why, but I think it's probably because I wanted to get back to that. I wanted to get back to the past, but I didn't know how to. Grace and Becca, did you both do sort of heritage studies / heritage management type masters?
Yeah, so my course, I did heritage studies, and I did that because I kind of didn't want to limit myself to go into museology or archiving and such. So it was very academic, as all courses are, but it definitely made open my sense to how big heritage is and what you can do within that. Whether you want to go into conservation or if you want to do community engagement or learning side of it. And especially topics like decolonization. I was definitely naive going into that. I think you definitely start questioning things within heritage, as in, do you know, why is this object over in a British Museum not in its original country? Or, you know, why are we conserving this building and whose perspective that's from, which is definitely important. But I think maybe as such, which doing a master's, it kind of, which is getting a job, is experience. And I think that's the main thing for me getting into the sector, is most job wants experience or in this and that. And, you know, when I've just done 4 years of studying, you feel a bit deflated. You're like, oh God, I've done all this work to then find out I need more experience, which is hard to get. But it's one of them where the passion for heritage, it does keep you going, and you just have to think, you have to stay resilient in that.
So I was actually, I was the opposite of Becca. I done like a non-heritage related master's. I done an MLIT in interdisciplinary English studies. So I now feel like on my job now, like I feel like my master's gave me like the knowledge of theory and literature, whether that be like literary theory, social theory, cultural theory, political theory. And now I'm trying to understand more about like how old buildings work, and I'm trying to understand more about like heritage skills and heritage phrases and like stuff like that. I've done a maintaining traditional buildings course at the Scottish Lyme Centre a couple of weeks ago, and it was just like all new information for me because it's something I've not done a heritage related degree. That was something that was completely different for me, so yeah.
I'm hoping to do the Museum Association AMA possibly next month, so that's probably going to be my experience, is because again, my similar to you, Grace, that I didn't do a master's, but my degree isn't heritage based either, it's language based, so I think I'm going to go in there and I'll just be overwhelmed with like all of the sort of technical information that I just like haven't got through like a sort of a university or a college course. So yeah, totally sympathize.
Growing up in my generation, which is probably end of millennial, beginning of Gen Z, I always knew that I was never going to get a set career. You know, there was never going to be one job that would last me until I was 60, whatever. And I always knew that. And I was okay with that because that kind of suits how my brain works, where I'll find something really interesting and work on it and become good at it. And then I'll think of something else. I think, oh, that's interesting. I'll go off and do that. So that suits me. But it's always been an awareness of thinking, well, I'll dot around and do a bit of everything. So I don't know whether, I mean, I found, like I said, that suits the way I work. But I mean, to some people that might be a bit disconcerting because they might want to have something that's more permanent and reassuring, that they know that if they commit to it, then it will be able to keep them going for decades into the future.
You become more resilient as well because your experiences just become more varied as a result. Like, it's great if you can stay in a job for, you know, like you say, more, you know, up to 60 years. But yeah, and for our generation, it's unlikely these days. But maybe it just makes you a bit more resilient to, and a bit just more broad in your skill set, I think, as well. Like, it can be scary on the one hand in terms of life responsibilities, you know, when you've got like I said, bills to pay for, and you know you've got kids or pets and stuff to look after as well as yourself. But that flexibility does make you better in the long run in terms of what you can bring to a sector like heritage then.
Yeah, I'm definitely finding that. I mean, like, just job searching, you know, you see a lot of roles, but they're either, like you said, part-time or even voluntary. So it's just hard. Like, at some point I would like to move out of home, but do you know, on a part-time job, will you have to get another one? And I think, yeah, and it's even entry-level jobs, so even doing a master's, I have quickly realised that I've got this degree, but it does mean something. But, you know, for job searching, not necessarily, because you are starting from the bottom again and just feel like you are retraining yourself after all those years of education. And I think, like you said, just opening the sector up for more positions for graduates to get into it, then that's like another thing, because it's few of the jobs is sort of like senior positions. And obviously for someone like me, I can't apply for that, or that's not really possible.
There almost needs to be like a maybe like an approach where you can have like these entry level roles, but there has to be like from like the employer like an identifiable pathway that could either be like progression or like a transition to the side. So someone could do like an entry level role in heritage, and as if the employer is supportive of it, they could have this thing where you can go, well, we'll if there's time for it, we'll give you this chance to apply for this sort of role within this department, or if you've got an interest in another field within the sector, here's this person that I know, here's my network that I'm going to share with you. So maybe there's work to be done in terms of that, having like those entry-level roles where there's like an identifiable pathway, but that sort of responsibility lies on like the employer, not the potential employees, because it needs to be like a
a two-way process, because I think everyone's passion is amazing, and like, we got it, you know, this is the reason this podcast is sort of here at the beginning, is like, we're all passionate about it and want to talk about it, and that sort of passion and that support for that sector needs to be reflected by the employers if they can.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when, I don't know if this is the same for you guys, but when I decided to do heritage, I thought, right, it's so niche, there won't be anyone, surely there's not anyone else my age that is also going to be fighting me for these jobs. And actually there's loads of people of this generation that really want those sort of jobs, which I didn't know. It was almost like a sort of hidden community. So if I was talking to my other friends that aren't as bothered about heritage, it would almost be quite complicated to explain what it is or why I want to do it, or, you know. But I don't know whether that's what you guys find, whether you know lots of people that are interested in the same thing, or whether you had to seek out the community to kind of get validation that it is a valid career or a valid interest. I don't know.
I think sort of like a lot of the time, like in any job role, like sort of your competitors are invisible, because like you never know who else has applied for a role that you've gotten into. And depending on where you're based, maybe like the heritage community or the sector that you're particularly working in within heritage can be quite small. So it's kind of the opposite's true. Then you go, oh, well, I actually know that this person is going to probably go for this role, and I know that this person is going to go for this role. So I think it can be a little bit, again, it can be very hard not to compare yourself to others, particularly if you're suffering from, like, you know, maybe a little bit of lack of self-confidence. I think, you know, any young person sort of goes through like episodes of feeling like maybe like a little bit conscious of maybe like a lack of skills or a lack of experience, and that's no like error on their part, that just happens to be where you are currently in your life. You know, if you're a young person, you're not going to have as much experience as someone else within that sector, but at the same time it's actually kind of comforting to know that that sector that you are really passionate about isn't sort of niche and odd, for you to have really found something invigorating and interesting about it. There are many other people who feel the exact same way as you, and yeah, it can be a bit disappointing when it's can be very competitive for certain roles, but to know that there is like other people out there, particularly people like your own age as well, who are just as equally fascinated by the sector as you, does mean that you don't feel like, you know, maybe accusations of being a bit nerdy in school or in university, like actually they're really unfounded, because it's a really exciting sector for a lot of people, and that's where they want to end up at the end of the day.
Yeah, I wonder if it's actually only a negative if you're looking for a job and there's a lot of competition, whereas all the other positives are the fact that you have got people your own age that are interested in it, you kind of feel more reassured that there's a generation growing up that do care about preserving heritage and bringing it into the present day and trying to make it inclusive for everyone. So maybe it's just because we feel so much pressure to get a job and succeed at a young age, and especially if we've chosen something that's a bit of a more unique career path, maybe because there is so much pressure, we sort of, it's tempting to see it as, oh, there's, you know, there's just so much competition, I'm never going to get a job. And then you think, actually, no, that's great. There's loads of people that actually, if we were all in the same room and we didn't have to worry about getting a CV in or a personal statement or whatever, or references, we'd actually probably have a really good chat and have some really good ideas between us. So,
Yeah, it's like what Becca said about like studying decolonization, because in a way that's like a really good indication for like the future of like what the heritage sector is going to be like, because there are a lot of people sort of our generation who are interested in things like decolonizing collections or making heritage more sustainable and like climate initiatives through heritage. And because those are the sort of topics that like young people are interested in, there's already like a future community of fellow potential future colleagues who, you know, you could actually take those sort of ideas and really run with them. So if you end up in the sector altogether, that's like a group of people really passionate about that subject, and that will actually go on to address and make those changes that we want to see for the better. Because, you know, having that sort of passion for things like sort of climate action or decolonization is stuff that is going to be a bit of a, it could be a bit of a slog depending on where you are and the circumstances, budget, logistics, but having those people alongside you shows you that this, you're not like an island, you're not an individual having just these individual thoughts. Everyone is thinking these and wants to make the sector more inclusive for everyone as a result.
Yeah, and I also feel like having, like, especially with this youth forum, for example, I don't know about you guys, but it's, even if it's just like an hour long meeting on Zoom, it really like cheers me up. Like, I feel like it really is like quite a, it's like a really reassuring thing, because sometimes we have like, you know, we've got like an agenda and we go through our points, but we also just have like a bit of a chit chat. And a lot of times it's like we're all feeling the same things, we're all going through the same things because we're all like a similar age. And, you know, me and Becca went to the Heritage Network conference in Dunfermline in September, and there was a real like team of us, like as young people, and it really felt like we were taking over. And I was like, this is like, if we want to see change, I do think we need to listen to young people, because a lot of times new ideas are coming from that newer generation. As you were saying, Kate, like with decolonization, making things more inclusive, loads of different things. I do think people need to be listening to younger people, because we've got great ideas.
Yeah, we do. Speaking of ideas, we did have a topic that we were going to talk about in this podcast. So I don't know whether we just go straight into it, guys, or we try and introduce a little bit, give a bit of context.
That was a great segue.
Thank you. I wish I could say, and I worked on it, but I didn't. We're here today on this podcast because we do have a topic that we did want to discuss as a little gang. And that idea was digitization in the heritage sector. And what we meant by that was digitization is a really key and sort of really emerging field within heritage at the moment, and it has a lot of benefits, particularly in like preserving collections, like improving archiving methodologies, also allowing better access for like the public and anyone sort of outside of sort of the heritage sector themselves to see these objects, particularly, you know, even if someone way across the other side of the world can actually see these objects without ever having to step inside the doors, which is absolutely amazing. But we're sort of coming at it from the perspective of young people, in that how digitization has affected us as young people. And that could be certain things that we see a lot of the time now, particularly with, like, say, concerts or theatre shows, where like the tangible objects that you might connect with, like, to a memory or a positive time for you, such as like concert stubs or theatre programmes, you don't get as much now because those sort of things are all online or mostly online. So our people's or young people's ability to really connect and have a sort of a physical personal connection to something lessen because we live in a more digitized age now. Do we really, really value those times where we can have those physical, tangible objects, such as like an album cover or a vinyl? You know, these sort of things are becoming really popular, particularly with young people, because of that sort of more unique time to have something physical and tangible. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I've got kind of like my personal view on it and also my sort of work view of it, because at work we have an online digital catalogue for all of our archival and museum collections. And I think without that, I mean, we're quite a small local archive, but I think without that, we just, no one would know what we had in our collections. We've got some amazing things. And we get emails from people in Australia and America who've just stumbled across it. They've searched something in Google and they found it, and they wouldn't have found it otherwise. And obviously the majority of it is just text-based. So some things have photos attached to them. But even then, I think nothing beats seeing the original item. But then it's because of it's the fact that it has been digitized to some extent that means people now know that it exists. And then from a personal view, my life has become increasingly online and digital. So I think the museums that have and archives and other heritage centers that have older items, they're not going to go anywhere. So something from the 14th century is still going to be there as a physical object for people to visit. But I think if you're talking about more modern museums that are starting from scratch with purely digital collections, I think that's where the issue will be in the next 10, 20 years.
There's a thing, isn't there, where they say that, you know, like say like the diaries of like prime ministers and stuff were kept in museum collections bearing their name. I think there's a David Lloyd George Heritage Centre up in North Wales that has some of his diaries from when he was a young man and from when he was an MP. But like you said, if you're living in a more digitised age, are we actually going to be preserving things that were in a digital space to begin with, such as social media posts and maybe like images that are just being generated by AI, for example? Will we be preserving that sort of digital world amongst us ourselves? And I don't even know if that really gets covered in sort of university colleges or master's degrees at the moment. Becca, have they covered anything when you were doing your course?
We definitely had a discussion on it. I think just we had a lecture on this. They kind of framed it as a transition towards digitalization and what that means. I know there was definitely a course on digital heritage now, which is brand new. So I think it is I don't know where I stand on it. It's quite, I see the good and the bad in it, digitalization. Like Emily said, how accessible objects can be. You can be halfway around the world and you can see all these objects. But I also see maybe a negative side, as in, you know, you are seeing it on a computer screen and you are losing that kind of value of seeing it inside, like in real life. And I think also maybe on a personal note for me is, if I go and see an exhibition or a display, I kind of go because I want to get away from screens and I want that time off my phone and to connect with history or heritage and to see it. So I don't know if anyone else experienced that or if it's just me.
Same thing. I definitely agree with that. I think with my job, it's like all online. I work from home. So I'm constantly surrounded by my laptop and my phone, nothing new, I'm sure. Most of us are like that. So I think when it comes to doing stuff outside of work, I kind of can't wait to put them both down and like get out there and actually experience like real things. And I think that's kind of why like I've always been a bit of a collector of just items of any sort. And I think that's actually getting like more and more. Like I'm doing it more and more as I get older. And I think that is like a reaction to digitization and a reaction to like how present our phones are in our lives. Like the thing I hate the most is getting rid of concert tickets. I do not want just a wee barcode on my phone. It's not special, it's not nice. I collected all my this is my soapbox. I collected all my concert tickets until I was like 18, and then they just stopped doing it. So yeah, bring back concert tickets.
Yeah, because like everyone really responded to like the friendship bracelets from like Taylor Swift's like last concert tour across the world. And actually there are people just dressing up as concerts as well. Like I don't know if like the older generations before has had that sort of real sort of like community costume in a way like that you might have seen from like the Taylor Swift tour. And that is all like physical, tangible stuff. You know, there's like so many glittery boots, so many cowboy hats. And like I said, there's like sort of plastic friendship bracelets. So I can really see like how people will have like a really personal, like really strong memory because of those tangible, like physical objects, not just having like an online, like you say, barcode for like the Taylor Swift concert that they saw in London, but they'll actually still have like maybe the costume, and that could be like some part of like a collection one day. And you know, the barcode and the phone's not going to be maybe in a museum exhibit, but maybe like the Taylor Swift fans' costumes are. I'm a big fan of Florence Welch and like Florence and the Machine, and there was a whole Instagram page that was set up that was just documenting people's costumes, and they were gorgeous, sort of like pre-Raphaelite style and sort of jewel-toned clothing. And it wasn't, I don't have a, it was lovely seeing all of these images, but, and I can remember a couple of them, but actually what my strongest memory was actually me, myself, actually going to a Florence and the Machine gig myself and just seeing the costumes that people had created in person. That's the stronger memory for me than actually just having the Instagram sort of digitized archive, informal archive of it. So that's sort of my, like on a personal level, I think having those sort of physical, tangible objects creates more striking memories for people. And that will like sort of encourage that connection where like maybe those certain physical objects for in a collection that you see in a museum will end up having a better association for you, or more positive experience for you than maybe see like a digital screen maybe telling you about what the object is in of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something about there's definitely something in the idea that we're trying to get back to almost a pre-digital age. I think we were so excited when it first started, you know, like I remember with iPods and phones and how there's more storage, and thought, oh, brilliant, you know, and I can download apps and I can message people. And I think just as that becomes normal and you realize that we're probably doing it a bit too much, you do get nostalgic for when things were a bit simpler, you know, and you just had, you know, maybe a ticket, or I don't know, maybe, I mean, for example, for my birthday last year, we went to a National Trust property in Northumberland, and they had like basically what you would have had when I was younger in the 2000s when you went to go and get digital copies, well, no, like physical copies of photos from film. But this was, you got five free photos or something, and you chose them from your phone to turn them into physical photos that I would have had when I was maybe four. So it was like that, the novelty of that, people were so excited. And that was just, it was us trying to go backwards, because we actually thought, actually, that was quite nice having just like a highlights reel of, you know, that was the only version of that memory you could get. Maybe there was like a fingerprint in the, you know, like a big finger in the camera, or you know, there was some kind of glare on the lens or something, but those photos had a bit more, I don't know, maybe because they were limited and you could only get a certain amount. I think it's just we've got used to having as much as we want, and we actually want to put a bit of a limit on that just to be able to enjoy things a bit more.
Definitely. And I guess there's like, you don't have instant gratification like maybe with, say, you know, with a camera back in the day. You know, you had to, like you said, you only had maybe like 30, 35 yeah. pictures you could have on a particular camera, and then you'd have to get them developed. So there was like the anticipation sort of created more excitement about something and maybe created like a better, more significant memory for you as a result, because you couldn't be satisfied straight away. Whereas maybe with digitization, maybe in a personal sphere, maybe rather than heritage, that instant gratification means you sort of get almost like bored with it in a way that you just want more, and you can have more. So it's a complex sort of topic to really sort of break down. Yeah, particularly for a young person as well, because I think we have like a foot sometimes in the sort of the older way of like physical objects, more tangible objects, and but also having very much a foot in like the digitization. Everything's going to be online. Our communities can be online as well. Like, you know, if you've got like someone who's LGBTQ+, you know, a lot of that community is online, and that is absolutely amazing because it shows the community, you know. And then you know, it's a solidarity. You're not the only young person who happens to identify that way, but maybe you do sort of lose that sort of more one-on-one personal connection because your community of young people don't really meet as much publicly in a public sphere that you might meet at a concert, might meet in a youth club back in the day. You know, your spaces are online, and do you lose something as a result because of that?
I do think for like the LGBTQ plus community, like it's all about representation. And I know for me growing up, I was quite obsessed with Tumblr. A lot of the times, like, the representation was so crucial to understanding your own identity, and I still find that. Like, there's a lot of LGBTQ plus podcasts that I watch on YouTube, etc., and I think they're so crucial for those communities to exist online, and a lot of times they can open people's eyes to, like, things that they might not have realised in their own life. So as much as there's a lot of kind of negatives to digital, I definitely think there are also loads of positives.
If it can go hand in hand, it's like the best of both worlds. Like, I love it when they have like these sort of like small towns or small villages and they have their first ever pride. And it's just absolutely amazing because like that sort of thing works really well in the digital age as well, because it really just shows like the communities there. And also there's like a great sort of just an archive of the memory as well, in a way, because then you get to really sort of proclaim out loud, like, you know, I'm this young person who's based in a very small rural town somewhere in the UK, but my town was able to hold its first pride, and now I've got like these amazing memories that are now preserved forever online. And it can actually just grow momentum for those sort of events as well, you know, and it becomes like a growing tradition, I think, sort of you know, particularly in places that they wouldn't, might never have done it otherwise. And having like the physical, personal experiences of, say, like someone's first pride, but having it somewhere digitized and archived for eternity is just an amazing way to go to sort of marriage the two worlds, really.
So is there anything that you guys collect? Do you have your own collections of anything?
So I, each time I go to a place, I get a postcard. So I've got quite a few now. They're all in my little box under my bed. But yeah, each place I go, I get a postcard off the place, and I just, yeah, I hang my most memorable holidays or places I visit on my wall. Yeah, but that's what I collect. I don't know about anyone else.
I've started... books technically, I think, was my sort of big collection thing. I'm not an ebook person. I still like a physical book in my hand. But I have also started like collecting proper theatre programmes as well. I've got a little whole stash from an Edinburgh Fringe I went to a couple of years ago, and I've sort of built on that ever since.
I'm like the same. I also collect postcards from places I go, and I also collect books, but I also collect vinyls as much when I can, because they are really expensive. So I try and find cheap ones. And then I also love like wee trinkets, like Miffy and Snippy. So cute. So I like wee kind of cute wee trinkets.
I think I'm the same as Kate in that it's books, like particular authors. I mean, I grew up going to secondhand bookshops with my parents, so I think just the same authors, but just multiple copies of really nice copies and editions of the same books, like detective fiction. So, but yeah, got too many. It's like when you get to four copies of the same thing, you think,
You can never have too many.
Things is not going anywhere. We still like a mixture of the physical and a mixture of the digital.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've come to the end of our chat. Thank you very much to the C Word podcast for inviting us on and letting us speak about all things conservation, heritage, being a young person. We really enjoyed it, and we really hope you enjoy listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with our upcoming episodes, please do follow us on social media. It will be under Heritage Network. And if you are 18 to 30 and would like to get involved with the Youth Forum, also check out our website. We are the Heritage Network Youth Forum.
Hey everybody, this is Liz, and I'm here to discuss a book that I recently read from Getty Publications about the 17th century female artist Jacina Taborsch by Adam Eaker. This was a fantastic book, top to bottom. Now, I selected to read it because I already know quite a bit about 17th century Dutch art. I do live in Amsterdam, so that's a lot of the art that I work on as a conservator as well. Plus, it has a personal interest for me. I give tours of the Rijksmuseum, and I really do love 17th century art, although it's something that I had to sort of discover for myself once I started living here in the Netherlands. So I had never heard of Jacina Taborsch before, but while reading the book, I realized that I am familiar with some of the art of her half-brother, Gerard Taborsch the Younger, and then her father was Gerard Taborsch the Elder. And being in an artist family was how a lot of female artists of the 17th century came to be painters. In Jacina's case, she mostly worked in watercolor, although she did do quite a few oil portraits that are now getting more and more often attributed to her because there's such an interest right now in 17th century female artists, which the author Adam Eaker really capitalizes on throughout the book. I learned that Jacina Taborsch was part of a very wealthy family in Zwolle, which is in the eastern part of the Netherlands, and her artistic skills were very limited to art books that she did, which was popular for well-to-do women at the time. So they basically collected drawings or poems or samples of their calligraphy together into these books. But Jacina, because she actually has like a genuine interest in her artistry, she really curated it and used it, these art books, as a way to display her artistic acumen. In fact, one of the first watercolors in her artist book is a really interesting piece called The Triumph of Painting Over Death, and it falls within a larger style of art where you have an artist sort of like at the center of the painting, and it's them showing how amazing they are and worthy of triumphing over fate. And the way that Jacina has depicted this is she has herself on top of like a skeleton, and her foot is on top of a devil creature, while she's painting and being attended to by angels, and the light streaming in through the window is sort of like the light of genius and artistry. It was really cool to see that she placed herself at the center of this narrative as well, and like she's actually saying, I am an artist, in this very confident way. And that's something that I realized throughout the book, is that Jacina was very much sure of herself. She saw herself as an artist, but she also took on the responsibility as the family historian. So like I said, there were two other artists in her family, her father and her half-brother, and she very much documented their skills as artists as well, often doing copies of her brother's work, perhaps posing for him in a few of the paintings that he did of, you know, more aristocratic life in the genre 17th century paintings that he has. And then she also commemorates her younger brother quite thoroughly. When he passed away at war, he fought for the Dutch against the English in the 1600s. And she marks his death multiple times throughout these art books, as well as doing some portraits of her half-brother for his death. It's just interesting to see that she's the one who's responsible for maintaining this legacy of her family and how seriously she takes it. Of course, she commemorates herself as well. In another one of my favorite pieces from her art book, it's a self-portrait inscribing the trunk of a tree. And it's painted in the countryside around Zwolle. She's leaning over a tree on the far right of the landscape with some of her friends walking in the distance. You know, they're all on a hike together, essentially. And she's taken a knife in the middle of this walk and is inscribing her name into the trunk of the tree. And this was actually a painting that she did to commemorate her 30th birthday. Presumably, she's inscribing her name into the tree to remember the day as significant in her life. And I was so inspired by this. I've actually been to Zwolle before, and looking at this landscape, it's just so classically Dutch. I can very easily picture this scene happening. And I was like, you know, I'm about to turn 30 in a year or two. Not the worst idea to do a little drawing and inscribe my name into the trunk of a tree. That sounds like it would be a nice little callback to Jacina, because I'm really liking her. I'm so happy that I got to learn so much about her through this book. I really want to highlight how fantastic the photographs are of the different paintings, especially the images that are taken from her artist books, which of course had to be scanned and digitized. And it's only through this digitization that we're able to experience these pieces within the book and disseminate more information about her as an artist, which is something that the author, Adam Eaker, actually mentions in his epilogue, where he talks about the dissemination of her artwork over the last few decades and how it's really only now that we have these scans of the book that we're able to learn so much about it without ever having to come into contact with the book, which feeds back into what the Youth Heritage group was talking about earlier in this episode. So I'm happy to be able to tie it into that. And I appreciate the digitization. It's incredible. I learned so much about her as an artist as a result. And I highly recommend this book to anybody who's interested in what it was like to be a woman in the 17th century in the Netherlands, but also a female artist. And then maybe more specifically about Jacina herself, because she is a complex figure that I'm going to think about for many weeks to come, thanks to this book.
Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've been listening to the people from the Heritage Trust Network Youth Forum. Thanks again for doing this. Join us next time for an episode about bioplastics. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show, email us at thecwordpodcast@gmail.com, or find us on social media. We're on almost everything. The intro and outro music is Spring Buddy the Music, used under Creative Commons Attribution License. As always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.